And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is December the 8th, 342nd day of the year. 23 days remain till the year's over with. On this day in 395... later, Yan is defeated by its former vassal, Northern Wei, at the Battle of Kanhe Slope. 757, Du Fu returns to Chang'an as a member of Emperor Xianzong's court after having escaped the city during the An-Lushan Rebellion. 877, Louis the Stammerer, son of Charles the Bald, is crowned king of the West Frankish kingdom of Compiègne. 1432, the first battle between the forces of Svitrigaila and Sigismund Castellatius is fought near the town of Osmiana, launching the most active phase of the Lithuanian Civil War. 1504, Ahmad ibn Abi Jumrah writes his Oran Fatwa, arguing for the relaxation of Islamic law requirements for the forcibly converted Muslims in Spain. Yes, if you don't believe the way we want you to believe, we will kill you. That'll teach you. 1660, a woman, either Margaret Hughes or Anne Marshall, appears on an English public stage for the first time in the role of Desdemona in the production of Shakespeare's play Othello. Until that point in time, all parts were played by men. 1851, conservative Santiago-based government troops defeat rebels at the Battle of Lancomilla, signaling the end of the 1851 Chilean Revolution. 1854, in his Apostolic Constitution, in a Fabulius Dos, Pope Pius IX proclaims the dogmatic definition of Immaculate Conception, which holds the Virgin Mary was conceived free of original sin. Now, they never gave an explanation. It's just something you have to believe or they'll kill you. In 1864, Pope Pius IX promulgates the encyclical Quanta Cura and its appendix, the Syllabus of Errors, outlining the authority of the Catholic Church and condemning various liberal ideas. Again, if you don't believe the way he wants you to believe, they'll kill you. 1907, King Gustav V of Sweden accedes to the Swedish throne. 1912, leaders of the German Empire hold an imperial war council to discuss the possibility war might break out. 1914, World War I. A squadron of Britain's Royal Navy defeats the Imperial German East Asia Squadron in the Battle of the Falkland Islands in the South Pacific. 1941, World War II. President Roosevelt declares December 7th to be a date which will live in infamy, after which the U.S. declares war on Japan. Also in 41, World War II, Japanese forces simultaneously invade Shanghai International Settlement, Malaya, Thailand, Hong Kong, the Philippines, and the Dutch Indies. Now, that was immediately upon conclusion of the attack at Pearl Harbor. 1943, World War II, the German 117th Jäger Division destroys the monastery of Megasipliao in Greece and executes 22 monks and visitors as part of reprisals that culminated a few days later with the massacre of Calavrita. 1953, President Eisenhower delivers his Atoms for Peace speech, which leads to an American program to supply equipment and information on nuclear power to schools, hospitals, and research institutions around the world. 1955, the flag of Europe is adopted by the Council of Europe. 1962, workers at four New York City newspapers go on strike for 114 days. That number eventually increases to nine New York City newspapers. 1963, Pan Am Flight 214, which was a Boeing 707, is struck by lightning and crashes near Elkton, Maryland. Kills all 81 people on board. 1966, The Greek ship SS Heraklion sinks in a storm in the Aegean Sea. Over 200 die in that sinking. 1969, Olympic Airways Flight 954 strikes a mountain outside of Kerateia, Greece, kills 90 people in the worst crash of a Douglas DC-6 in history. 1971, Indo-Pakistani War. Indian Navy launches an attack on West Pakistan's port city of Karachi. 1972, United Airlines Flight 553, a Boeing 737, crashes after aborting its landing attempt at Chicago Midway International Airport. 45 people die. That's the first ever loss of a Boeing 737. 1974, plebiscite results in the abolition of the monarchy in Greece. 1980, John Lennon is murdered by Mark David Chapman in front of the Dakota, which is an apartment complex in New York City. Been there. It's quite an interesting place. 1985, the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, the regional intergovernmental organization geopolitical union in South Asia, is established. 1987, Cold War. Intermediate range nuclear forces treaty is signed by President Reagan and Soviet leader Gorbachev in the White House. 1987, Israeli Army tank transporter kills 4 Palestinian refugees and injures 7 others during a traffic accident at the Erez crossing on the Israel-Gaza Strip border. It was cited as one of the events that sparked the first Intifada. Now, that was a sustained series of Palestinian protests and riots on the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and inside Israel itself. It was against the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza that begun 20 years before. Intifada lasted from December 1987 till the Madrid Conference in 1991. Some do date its conclusion to 1993 with the signing of the Oslo Accords. When in doubt, protest. 1988, U.S. Air Force A-10 Thunderbolt II crashes into an apartment complex in Remscheid, Germany, kills 5 people and injures 50 others. 1990, the Galileo spacecraft flies past Earth for the first time. 1991, the leaders of Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine sign an agreement dissolving the Soviet Union and establishing the Commonwealth of Independent States. 1992, the Galileo spacecraft flies past Earth for the second time. 1998, 81 people are killed by armed groups in Algeria. 2004, the Cusco Declaration signed in Cusco, Peru, establishing the South American Community of Nations. Also in 2004, Columbus nightclub shooting. Nathan Gale opens fire at the Rosa Villa nightclub in Columbus, Ohio. Kills former Pantera guitarist Dimebag Darrell and 3 others before being shot by a police officer. 2009, bombings in Baghdad, Iraq, kill 127 and injure 448 others. 2010, with the second launch of the Falcon 9 and the first launch of the Dragon, SpaceX becomes the first private company to successfully launch, orbit, and recover a spacecraft. 2010, the Japanese solar sail spacecraft Icarus passes the planet Venus at a distance of about 80,800 kilometers. 2013, riots break out in Singapore after a fatal accident in Little India. 2013, Metallica performs a show in Antarctica, making them the first band to perform on all 7 continents. And in 2019, the first confirmed case of COVID-19 in China took place on this date. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays observances. In the Falkland Islands, it is Battle Day, Bodhi Day in Japan, CARICOM, Cuba Day in the Caribbean community and Cuba, Christian Feast Day, Budak of Dal, Clement of Ohrid, Students Day in Bulgaria, Eucharius, Feast of the Immaculate Conception, that's a public holiday in several countries, a holiday of obligation in others. In the Anglican Communion, it is Conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary, Fiesta de Concedo de Praia, celebrating Yamana, Queen of the Ocean, in Salvadoran Bahia. Festival of Lights in Leon, Mother's Day in Panama, Lady of Cameroon Day in Guam, Patapios of Thebes, Pope Eutychian, Richard Baxter in the Episcopal, U.S. Episcopal Church, Romaric, Constitution Day in Romania, Constitution Day in Uzbekistan, Day of Finnish Music in Finland, of all places, Early Stanwix National Tree Planting Day can fall, December 14th is the latest. It's celebrated on the second Monday in December in Malawi, Hari Kuyuo in the Kansai region of Japan, and in Albania it is National Youth Day. Let's see what else we got. In 1326, Daito Koji Temple in the Rinzai Line, established in Kyoto by Daito Kokushi. 1609, Biblioteca Ambrosiana in Milan opens its reading room. That's the second public library in Europe. 1659, the Mexican border town of Ciudad Juarez is founded by Fray Garcia de San Francisco. 1710, the Battle of Brihuega in the War of Spanish Succession. British General James Stanhope is captured by French and Spanish forces. On this day in 1776, George Washington's retreating army crossed the Delaware River from New Jersey. In 1792, the first cremation in the U.S. Name was Henry Lawrence. 1794, the first issue of the Herald of Rutland, Vermont is published. 1863, 2,500 people killed as a result of the fire at the Jesuit Church of La Campana, Santiago, Chile. 1863, Lincoln issues his amnesty proclamation and plans for reconstruction of the South. 1864, the Clifton Suspension Bridge, designed by Isambard Kingdom Brunel, is finally opened in Bristol, England, 5 years after he died. 1869, the 20th Roman Catholic Ecumenical Council, Vatican I, opens in Rome. 1874, on this date, Jesse James's gang takes a train at Muncie, Kansas. 1876, Suriname begins a compulsory education for children 7 to 12 years. 1880, 5,000 Aryan Boers gather in Padre Corral in South Africa. 1881, Vienna's Ring Theater destroyed by gaslight fire. Killed an estimated 384 to 1,000 people, depending on which report you read. 1886, American Federation of Labor, formed by 26 craft unions, elected Samuel Gompers, AFL president. 1895, the Battle of Amba Alagi, Ethiopian Emperor Menelik II drives Italian General Barrettieri out of the country. 1902, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. became Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. 1909, the Bird Banding Society is founded. 1913, the construction starts on the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco. 1914, well, that's the Battle of Falkland Islands. 1914, the Boers rebelling against the British in South Africa suffer a number of defeats on this date. One of their leaders, General Beyers, accidentally drowns. 1915, World War I soldier and poet John McCrae's poem In Flanders Fields appears anonymously in Punch magazine. 1921, Imone de Valera publicly repudiates Anglo-Irish Treaty. 1923, the German-U.S. Friendship Treaty is signed. 1931, coax cable is patented. 1933, French nun Bernadette Soubirous, who saw the vision of the Virgin Mary at Lourdes, is canonized by the Catholic Church. 1935, the Japanese military police launch a violent suppression of the religious sect Omoto, beginning with a crackdown on the sect's operational bases of Ayabi and Kamioka in Kyoto Prefecture, and its arrest of its leader, Onisaburo Deguchi. 1936, Anastasio Somoza Garcia elected president of Nicaragua. Also in 36, the NAACP filed suit to equalize salaries of black and white teachers. 1938, the highest temperature in December in U.S. history recorded in La Mesa, California. 1941, the Chelmno extermination camp opens up 50 kilometers from Lodz in Poland. 1941, in London, the Dutch government in exile declares war on Japan. 1941, the U.S. and Britain declare war on Japan, and the U.S. enters World War II. The 8th was the date of the speech that Roosevelt gave, calling December 7th a day that will live in infamy. 1946, U.S. Army rocket plane XS-1 makes its first powered flight. 1949, on this date, the film adaptation of the Broadway musical On the Town, which starred Gene Kelly, Frank Sinatra, Ann Miller, and Vera Ellen, is released. Vera Ellen was a well-known dancer. Saw her in many things. 1952, on this date, French troops shoot at demonstrators at Casablanca. 50 die. 1956, the first test firing of the Vanguard satellite program took place on this date. 1956, the 16th Summer Olympic Games close in Melbourne, Australia. It starts an Olympic tradition. Amidst international tensions, athletes mingled together, played into and around the arena for a final appearance to close the games. 1959, Dom Mintoff demands independence from Malta. 1960, on this date, the musical Peter Pan, starring Mary Martin, broadcast for a third time on NBC as a special event. Mary Martin was actually, I think, the mother of Larry Hagman, of I Dream of Jeannie fame. 1961, Antwerp, Belgium, diocese forms. 1962, there was an attempted coup in British-controlled Brunei. Also in 1962, there was a funeral for Queen Wilhelmina of Holland. 1963, Frank Sinatra Jr. is kidnapped at Harrah's in Lake Tahoe. There is a rumor that that was done to take the attention away from the Kennedy assassination. 1965, Pope Paul VI signs the Second Vatican Council. Also in 66, the U.S. and USSR sign a treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons in outer space. In 1969, the police launched a surprise attack on the Black Panthers in Los Angeles. 1970, head of the Catholic Church in Ireland, Cardinal William Conway, publishes a pamphlet about segregation and education in Northern Ireland. I've yet to figure out what it matters. Okay. On this date in 1980, Annie Leibovitz has a photo shoot with John Lennon, the last person to professionally photograph him before he was murdered on this same date. See if there's anything else. 1983, on this date, the ninth space shuttle mission, Columbia 6, lands at Edwards Air Force Base. Well, I think that is it for this particular history segment. We have been talking about a lot of strange things. Yesterday we were talking about dreams. You know, there's a long list of cases where dreams project the dreamer into the past. But there are a number of cases where dreams are seen to project into the future. One case in particular is about a boy named Adrian Christian. He lived on the Isle of Man. Now, in the year 1833, he first dreamed he was captain of a ship. His brother Thomas was on another ship that was sinking, and he rescued him. Now, Adrian Christian told the family about that dream, and his mother wrote it into the flyleaf of the family Bible. You see, over the next 3 years, Adrian had that same dream 5 different times. Identical in every detail. 47 years later, in September of 1880, he had good reason to remember that dream. He was captain of the ship British India, out of Sydney, bound for Rangoon. While taking a nap one afternoon, he dreamed once again his brother was on a ship that was sinking. And that night he had that same dream again, except he saw the word family scrawled on a piece of paper in the dream. Well, Captain Christian, giving in to his inclination, ordered the course of his own ship altered to due north, which took him into some dangerous waters. The next day, September 6, 1880, he sighted the sinking ship and rescued 269 people, including his own brother, Thomas, who was skipper of the sinking vessel. That ship was named The Family. But there's also the well-documented case of James Watt, inventor of the steam engine. In Watt's day, the manufacture of ordinary lead shot for fouling pieces was an awkward process that involved drawing the lead into wire and chopping the wire into bits, or chopping sheet lead into small squares and rolling the squares into heavy iron plate until they became roughly ball-shaped. Now, the process was cheap or highly effective. And then James Watt had a dream. According to his dream, he had that same dream night after night for almost a week. In it, he seemed to be walking through a heavy rainstorm in which the rain itself turned into tiny leaden pellets that bounced about on the ground.
So he began to wonder, well, what was the significance of the dream? Did it mean that molten lead falling through the air would harden into tiny spherical pellets? Well, unable to restrain his curiosity, he melted some lead over a small fire in a church steeple, and he tossed a kettle full of the molten metal over the railing and watched it shower into a water-filled moat down below. When he searched the moat, he found that the lead had in fact formed into round particles ideal for loading into guns. As a result of this experiment, all the other methods of making lead shot were discarded. From that day to this, lead shot's been made by dropping molten metal into water. All thanks to James Watt and his dream. Well, let's talk about Reverend Charles Morgan. For a number of years, he was the pastor of the Rosedale Methodist Church in Winnipeg, Canada. And it was customary for the musical director of the church to make a list of the hymns for the evening services and give that list to Reverend Morgan, who would then post them on the bulletin board. Well, he posted the list as usual and retired to his study for a nap before the evening service began. Well, he dreamed of the number of an old hymn that he hadn't heard in years. And he dreamed of it again, and in the background he heard the sound of voices and rushing water. Well, it was a disturbing dream. He felt as though he had been present at some great excitement that he couldn't see but could only hear. And there was an insistence in the back of his mind demanding that almost forgotten hymn. Well, after the regular services had been concluded that evening, Reverend Morgan felt an overpowering compulsion to give in to the demand of the strange dream, and he asked the congregation to sing that particular hymn. And one verse of that hymn is, "Hear, Father, while we pray to thee for those in peril on the sea." And interestingly enough, the date of this particular service was April 14, 1912. At the very moment his congregation was singing that hymn, one of the great sea tragedies of all time was taking place in the North Atlantic. The Titanic was sinking. Now, from time immemorial, men have been baffled and often amazed by the mental phenomena called dreams. Sometimes frightening, sometimes comforting, sometimes just absolutely amusing. Dreams occasionally have another quality. They seem to transcend both time and space. At a Baltimore grade school, a 7-year-old boy offered the classic definition of dreams when he replied to his teacher, "Dreams are TV you see in your sleep." Through this childish simplicity, he reduced the phenomena to understandable proportions. For dreams, like television, seem to enable the recipient to ignore time and distance, with the results that sometimes surpass the concepts of conventional science. Now, there's also a story about a dream that actually shook the world. It was Sunday night. It was in Boston, Massachusetts. Byron Soames had tied one on, and he was sleeping off his bench in his office at the Boston Globe. Now, it was Monday morning in the Straits of Sunda, where the mightiest explosion in the history of mankind had just taken place. In his dream, Byron Soames watched the catastrophe as clearly as though he'd been watching it from midair, but he was actually 12,000 miles away. 2 days before the Boston newsman's remarkable experience, nature set the stage for catastrophe. The volcano of Krakatoa jutted up from an island in the Straits of Sunda. An earthquake had torn the islands of Java and Sumatra apart in the year 1115. Krakatoa was noted for its rumblings and recurrent eruptions. On August 25th, 1883, it began deep underground mutterings that quickly reached the intensity of cannon fire. By nightfall, the volcano was showering the island with boulders. Bridges collapsed, roads became impassable, ships had to head out to sea to elude the stones that were being shot in the air from the volcano. Great undersea explosions churned the seas around the island, and the temperatures of the water rose 65 degrees, literally overnight. Well, by noon of the 26th, the great volcano Mahameru, Java's largest, had joined in the thunderous chorus. And then Gunung Guntur, and a few hours later, the entire volcanic chain of the Kadangs was roaring its fury. They were called the Howitzers of Hell, and they were in full volume. The sea boiled around the Doom Island. The earth trembled. The nights were lit with the glow from the volcanoes. 15 of them roaring in unison. And then there was one explosion so vast it defied description. Island of Krakatoa disintegrated in one cataclysmic blast that sent earth shocks and airwaves around the globe. The tidal wave alone killed tens of thousands of people, some of them hundreds of miles away. There had been nothing like it in the annals of the human race. Well, in Boston on that hot Sunday night in August of 1883, Byron Soames awakened from his troubled sleep and sat there for a while, contemplating the nightmare he had just had. He could still hear in his mind the screams of those doomed people on that little tropical island as they sought vainly to escape from the fiery fate that awaited them. Well, he jotted down the details of the dream while they were fresh in his mind. The off chance it might be usable as a feature material for some dull news day, he marked the notes as important and put them on his desk and went home. Well, there was little news of the great Krakatoa disaster next day. Communications to the stricken sector were sparse at best, and the blast had virtually erased them. Now, he didn't come to work that day, but somebody found his notes and thought they were a report on the seismological disturbance that was puzzling the experts. Clearly, something tremendous had happened, but where had it happened? And then a fragmentary report from Batavia located the disaster at Krakatoa, and the Boston Globe on August 29th ran an excellent story based on the details in the notes Soames had jotted down. Well, the newspapers evidently predicated their stories on that of the Boston Globe. In a matter of a short time, his remarkable dream had been translated into widespread newspaper copy. Well, when his employers found Soames demanded details and more copy, he broke down and admitted his report hadn't been intended as a news matter. Nothing more than notes about a nightmare he had. Well, at that point, the higher up at the Globe probably experienced a nightmare of their own. At the discovery, they had printed a dream as though it was factual news, permitted other newspapers to duplicate it. Byron Soames was in a doghouse, and he lost his job. Well, before the Globe could make public confession, nature came to the rescue. Great waves began hammering at the west coast of the U.S., seismic waves generated by the explosion of Krakatoa thousands of miles away. News of the disaster began filtering in as survivors reached cities where telegraph facilities still functioned. As the news wires brought in the real story hour by hour, the amazing accuracy of the account based on the dream of Byron Soames became evident. Found himself back in the good graces of the Globe again. And the paper declined at that time to reveal the story behind the story. Eventually, the Globe explained that Soames' account of the Krakatoa disaster had been based on information from a coffee broker. This was later amplified to include another explanation that Soames had also been doing some research on volcanoes and tropical islands at the time of the Krakatoa incident. Well, in his remarkable dream, Byron Soames in Boston seems to have witnessed the explosion of Krakatoa halfway around the world at approximately the time it happened. His dreams were translated, accidentally, maybe, into a news story that was subsequently confirmed by conventional processes. During the dream, he kept hearing the word Prelapi. Made no sense at the time, but years later, through a Dutch historical society, he learned that Prelapi was an ancient native name for Krakatoa. It hadn't been used for over 200 years before he heard it in his dream that shook the world. Well, you know, mystery stories have fascinated everybody who's read them. And they were relatively new when Wilkie Collins induced his friend Charles Dickens to turn his talents in that direction. Dickens considered it carefully for several months before he began writing his first and only novel of that type. He called it The Mystery of Edwin Drood. He made arrangements to have the story published in 12 monthly installments in a magazine. And oddly enough, for the first time in his career, Dickens had insisted that the contract provide for payments to his heirs in case of his death. Well, certainly there was a possibility, and many people suspected that particular contract provision was based on a premonition Dickens had, and it was certainly well-founded because he died in 1870. He had only completed 6 installments of his intriguing story. Readers on both sides of the Atlantic were left to speculate on a solution which Dickens had in mind. Of course, that secret died with him, since he left no notes that might have provided a clue. But they got their answer from a young tramp printer who strolled into Brattleboro, Vermont in the year following Dickens' death. Thomas James was an easygoing, handsome, irresponsible girl chaser in addition to being an excellent printer. Spotting a very pretty young lady, he followed her home and rented a room just across the street from where the young girl lived. He soon discovered he was rooming at the home of an elderly lady who was an advocate of spiritualism, which was then very much in vogue. For about a year, he attended occasional sittings in his landlady's parlor, which the customary trances and rappings occurred. Well, if James was inspired or perhaps affected in any way, he kept it to himself till October 3rd, 1872. When he informed his landlady, he'd been in contact with the spirit of Charles Dickens, and the eminent author had given him power of attorney to complete the unfinished novel, The Mystery of Edwin Drood. Well, the landlady, of course, was flabbergasted to think that her carefully young boarder was so highly regarded by the late, great Mr. Dickens. And eager to do her part to help, she gave James free board and lodging until he completed the task. A number of witnesses later testified that James would retire to his room, slump in a chair, and go into trances that often lasted for hours. Afterward, he would write furiously, explaining to his friends he was creating nothing, merely writing down the material that Dickens had given him while he was entranced. Sometimes the material covered many pages, and other times it was only a few lines. Spirits, it seemed, also had difficulties in transmission when the weather was bad. And when the young tramp printer had his mind on some pretty girl, as he frequently did, then Mr. Dickens had to wait. Well, word of the strange project leaked out, of course, and newspapers promptly smelled a hoax. They set up a hue and cry of fraud, a sort of backfire, which they felt would foredoom this charlatan's work to failure. But they didn't take into account the outcome. When the manuscript appeared in the bookstalls on October 31st, 1873, less than a year after James began his task, even the experts of the literary world had to admit they were astounded. Here was the work of an unknown which seemed exactly as though Dickens himself had written it, or, as James insisted, dictated it. The scary young tramp printer became a literary lion almost overnight. Paper in Springfield, Massachusetts, called him a successor to Dickens himself. Boston paper said James couldn't have written this book without help from Dickens, be it spiritual or otherwise. Remained for Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, to investigate the strange case of Thomas James. In a December 1927 issue of the Fortnightly Review, Doyle reported that James showed no literary talent whatever before or after that one manuscript. His education ended at the age of 13 when he completed a course comparable to fifth grade in the average public school. But somehow he had acquired the style, vocabulary, and thinking processes of the great Charles Dickens. Inexplicable accomplishments for a poorly educated employee of an American printing company. According to Doyle, if it be indeed a parody, it has the rare merit among parodies of never accentuating or exaggerating the peculiarities of the original. What about Thomas James? He dropped out of sight as quickly as he had risen and died in complete obscurity. In a few libraries, there remain copies of what's called the James version of The Mystery of Edwin Drood. But you have to admit, it's probably considered a mystery within a mystery. Well, sometimes people appear from nowhere. And there's a case in point. The man in question was a strange one. Acted as though he had just dropped in from another world. He was found just outside the New Gate entrance to the city of Nuremberg, Germany, where an inquisitive policeman first noticed him. He was clean but superbly dressed. He was almost ragged. The policeman later told his superiors he had been first attracted to the young man by the difficulty which he seemed to walk, as though suffering from a deformity that caused him to stumble. And his feet were swollen. His eyes were squinted against the light. Well, the inquisitive policeman tried to question the young man, but he couldn't find out anything. Over and over, all the young man kept repeating was, "I want to be a soldier like my father." It didn't sound more like an expression of determination than it did a chant, as though the young man who uttered it was merely reciting words he didn't really understand himself. Well, the policeman took him to the station where the mayor and other local dignitaries gathered to observe and question this unusual visitor. In a monotone, young man continued to repeat his assertion he wished to be a soldier like his father. Well, to the basic question of what's his name, he didn't understand what they were saying, and he just stared at him. But when a pen was put in his hand, he giggled nervously and wrote in a slow, legible hand, "Caspar Hauser." He couldn't or wouldn't write anything else. And on that quiet but Monday afternoon in 1828, the young man had inscribed on the records the name that was marked the beginning of a puzzle that remains unsolved to this day. When food was put in front of him, he seized it in his hands and crammed it in his mouth as though he were famished. A mug of cold milk was evidently something he had never encountered before, and he recoiled from it. Water he drank, but not before he sampled it with a forefinger. Just before nightfall, while the baffled city fathers in Nuremberg were trying to decide what to do with their visitor, he presented him with two more pieces of the puzzle. Two letters wrapped in rags that he carried inside his vest. One letter purported to be from his mother, dated 16 years before. It urged anyone who found the boy to send him to Nuremberg when he was 17 so he could enlist in the 6th Cavalry, of which his father had been a member. The other letter was badly written and purported to be from somebody who found the boy and cared for him, but who could no longer support him. Oddly, both letters are written on some sort of thin leather or parchment that was not familiar to the officials in Nuremberg. And the young man, who identified himself as Caspar Hauser, if that was indeed his name, spent that first night with the city's most learned man, Dr. Dahmer, where he promptly astonished his host by trying to pick the flame off a candle. Further tests brought out that he had no depth perception whatever, and although he seemed to be in full possession of his faculties, they were as undeveloped as those of a baby. And although the condition of his feet and legs indicated he had walked a considerable distance, nobody could be found who had seen him on the road. So a reward was offered to anybody who could identify him. Pictures were distributed throughout Europe, but no results. The more the officials probed, the deeper the mystery of Caspar Hauser became. Now, under the kind and patient tutelage of Dr. Dahmer, Caspar learned quickly, first to speak and then to write. Told his newfound friends he had been raised since infancy in total darkness in a cellar. He never tasted anything except black bread and water. Had never seen the man who brought his food in total darkness. He seldom heard speech, and then only a few words. But how or why or where he had spent those years, he had absolutely no idea. In October 1829, he came stumbling out of Dr. Dahmer's basement, bleeding from a deep gash on the head that he said had been inflicted by a masked man wielding a long knife. So city officials assigned two policemen to guard him after that. But while they dozed on the afternoon of December 14, 1833, Caspar Hauser went for a stroll in the park across the street. He came back from that stroll staggering a few minutes later, dying from a stab wound. Surgeons said the wound could not have been self-inflicted. And the snow in the park revealed no footprints other than Casper's, and they never did find any trace of the murder weapon. The well-documented facts in the enigma of Caspar Hauser entitle it to a place in the records as one of the strangest cases of its time. Von Fehrbach wrote, Caspar Hauser showed such ignorance of the simplest facts of life and such horror of the necessities of civilization. One feels driven to believe he was a native of another planet, transferred by some miracle to our own, where he met his untimely end. Well, scientists were called in to investigate carefully and at length an interesting occurrence, but they found they had to admit defeat. They could arrive at no logical explanation for the strange events that were uncovered on that blazing afternoon, October 24th, 1943. That was when a group of Masonic officials opened a sealed grave on the island of Barbados. It was the tomb of Sir Evan MacGregor, who had been buried there in 1841. But the Masons weren't interested in Sir Evan. They wanted to pay tribute to one Alexander Irvin, the father of Freemasonry in Barbados. His remains had been placed in the same vault as MacGregor's, but prior to MacGregor being buried. The crypt itself had been carved out of the native stone of the island, was so constructed it projected almost 4 feet above ground, resting on a concrete and brick base that extended underground to a depth of an additional 4 feet. Entrance could be obtained only by descending a flight of 6 steps and opening a sealed door. And after the heavy cover slab had been removed, it was found the doorway to the vault itself was sealed up by being bricked up. Well, as the bricks were removed, while the waiting Masonic officials sweltered in the heat, workmen called attention to a metal object of some sort that was visible through the aperture where the bricks had been taken out. The more careful work and the nature of that metal object was unmistakable. It was a coffin covered in lead, leaning against the only door to the crypt. The head of the coffin was facing downward, and little by little the bricks were removed and the heavy coffin eased away from the door until it rested once again on the floor. Well, the Masonic delegation is understandably mystified. How did the 600-pound lead coffin of Sir Evan MacGregor get out of its niche on the opposite side of the vault? How did it get moved after the vault had been carefully sealed more than 100 years before? And what caused 3 tiny holes in the lead where it had been sealed with solder? Well, the Masons were confused, and they had little time to ponder the problems presented by this state of affairs, because they had another puzzle on their hands. There was absolutely no trace of either the coffin or the body of Alexander Irvin. His remains had vanished completely from the niche in the vault where they'd rested when MacGregor's coffin had been placed beside him. Both men had been entombed in heavy lead-covered coffins, put side by side on cement shelves. And now one coffin had vanished, and the other had somehow managed to cross the crypt and end up in a standing position against the sealed door. Well, the Masons put a guard on the tomb and went away to ponder the issue. They reported it to the authorities of Barbados, who in turn promptly called in several learned men to conduct an investigation. Examination of the records showed that both men had been entombed in that same crypt, and the crypt had been firmly sealed. All witnesses agreed the seals had been broken, and the crypt had been in perfect condition when the workmen began to open it up that hot afternoon of August 24, 1943. But somehow, in some time, the strange things had taken place inside that vault. After lengthy deliberation and careful investigation, the scientists came away as baffled as the Masons had been. All of them went away to ponder the unexplained disappearance of Alexander Irvin, whose remains should have been in that sealed tomb where they'd been placed. The only problem is they weren't there and nobody knew why. Well, the disturbances in the vault are by no means unparalleled, also in Barbados, but in a different cemetery miles from the scene of the Irvin mystery. Officials are plagued with the antics of the coffins in the vault of the Chase family. Time and after time, as various members of the family were taken to the crypt for entombment, the other coffins inside were found in wild disarray. In each case, they found the heavy capstone in position, sealed with a thick layer of molten lead, no traces of tampering. And in each case, when they finally removed the seals from the inner door, they found the inside a shambles. The lead-covered box that contained the body of Thomas Chase was so heavy it required 8 men to lift it, but time after time it was found upside down on the side of the crypt opposite the shelf where it belonged.
Oddly and maybe significantly, only two coffins remain untouched. Those of Mrs. Goddard, the original occupant of the tomb, and that of a baby girl, Miss Goddard's granddaughter. Armed guards placed beside the vault day and night were unable to prevent recurrences of the disorder. Eventually, the Chase family had to remove the bodies and re-entomb them someplace else. In the old Christchurch Cemetery of Barbados, the Chase vault still stands, its heavy stones and coral intact, and appropriately enough, carved into the thick capstone is a large question mark, a reminder of what you might refer to as the restless dead. Well, I'm always fascinated when ivory tower scientists make pronouncements that quite often turn out not to be true. For example, it was ivory tower scientists who said that rocks can't come from the sky because there are no rocks in the sky. Well, scientists also haven't found the answer to the great chunks of ice that come hurtling to Earth year after year. Nobody knows where they come from or why. The inhospitable moor that stretches alongside the Bristol Channel in North Devon and Somerset is noted chiefly for its fine sheep and the sought-after woolens woven from their fleece. But on the night of November 10, 1950, something new was added to the records of that quiet, once-slept countryside. Several times during that particular night, Edward Latham heard his sheepdog bark furiously. Now, his dog did that only when something was amiss, so he got up and went outside. Sky was clear, the weather chilly, but not colder than the wind that blew over the moor and probed through his garments. Seeing nothing unusual, he decided the dog was merely serving notice it was on duty. But the next morning, he had a surprise waiting for him. His dog was again barking furiously, this time in the field about 50 yards from the house. When Latham got to the spot, he found one of his sheep dead, a deep diagonal slash across the shoulders and down the neck, as though it had been struck with an axe. Beside the body of the sheep was a chunk of ice that he later ascertained weighed 14 pounds. That chunk of ice had fallen with such velocity it was buried in the sod to a depth of about 8 inches. Latham later told authorities his sheep had been killed as if it had been struck by lightning. And around the field, down the roadway, I found many other chunks of clear, hard ice, none of them, most of them the size of dinner plates or larger. After lengthy investigation, the British Air Ministry had to admit it was baffled. The ice hadn't come from planes or from storms, and strangely enough, the Air Ministry added the conditions don't suggest this is any normal meteorological or weather phenomena. Well, the excitement over this particular incident hardly subsided before it was repeated November 24, 1950. Again, the weather was mild, the skies were clear, and during the early hours of the night, a chunk of ice, a one-foot cube of it, came plunging to earth, crashed through the roof of a garage in Wandsworth near London, and made such a bang that the night watchman called police and reported a bomb explosion. Again, scientific study by the Air Ministry failed to solve the riddle. These unexplained ice falls are no means peculiar to England. In the middle of April 1958, a shower of ice came rattling down into the yard of Mr. and Ms. Leo Kozlowski in Napa, California. Big, jagged pieces of ice that were from 2 to 12 inches in diameter. Some of them buried half their length in the earth. There were no planes in the area. Then there's the remarkable experience of Edwin Groff, a farmer near Reading, Pennsylvania. He heard a whistling sound, and a moment later, a 50-pound chunk of ice about 2 feet in diameter smacked into the earth only a short distance from where he stood. He called his wife, and they both stood looking at that first chunk of ice. Another, slightly smaller, came whistling down behind it, and they, of course, called the sheriff, and he called the Air Force. And they called a meteorologist, and he called it natural ice that had been carried on the jet streams. That great river of air that warps itself around the globe from west to east at speeds up to 300 miles an hour. But of course, the jet stream theory of the falling ice had to be abandoned for the simple reason it couldn't carry chunks of ice suspended in midair. Edward Goff's ice blocks came whistling down July 30, 1957. On August 14th, more ice came down in formidable chunks at Gowan City, Pennsylvania. September 8, 1958, a whopping big chunk of ice roared through the roof of a warehouse at 510 North 3rd Street in Chester, Pennsylvania.
Strangest of all, though, was the experience that befell Mr. and Ms. Dominic Bagligalupo at 336 Greystone Road in Old Bridge, New Jersey on the night of September 2nd, 1958. They were watching TV in their living room about 9 in the evening when Mr. Bagligalupo went to the kitchen to get himself some coffee. As he sat down in front of the TV set, there was a shattering roar and a chunk of ice smashed a 3-foot hole in the roof and came through the ceiling of the kitchen. Like all the other ice falls before it, it remains unexplained. According to the British Air Ministry, this phenomenon is one of the biggest mysteries of the century. Well, let's go from ice falls to monsters. In this particular case, those who saw the thing were terrified, and those who investigated were convinced it had been there. But what was it, and where did it come from? They constitute the mystery of the Flatwoods Monster. Just getting dark on a warm September evening in 1952, and five youngsters stopped their play to watch a strange spectacle overhead. Outlined against the sky over the nearby mountains was a disc-shaped object that was spurting little streams of sparks. It wobbled just a bit, moved on hesitantly, and dropped slowly down toward the mountaintop where it settled among the trees. Whatever it might have been, it didn't resemble any plane the youngsters ever seen. They realized this was some sort of emergency, and they scattered to their respective homes to report to their parents. Eddie May, 13, and his brother Fred, 12, ran to the nearby home where their mother operated a beauty parlor in a little West Virginia community of 300 people. They told their mother excitedly that they and their companions had seen a plane or a flying saucer land on the foothill that towered above the town. Now, of course, Ms. May was skeptical, but that skepticism disappeared when she stepped outside to see for herself. And dimly visible several hundred yards away near the top of the hill was a slowly pulsating red light. There was something on the ground there, and just as the children had said, but what was it? Ms. May sent the boys running to the nearby home of Jean Lemon, 17, a member of the National Guard. Armed only with a flashlight, Lemon led the party up the hill. In addition to Ms. May and her two sons, the group also included 14-year-old Neil Nunley and a pair of 10-year-olds who had seen the object land, Ronnie Shaver and Tommy Heyer. The experience they encountered in the ensuing minutes put the little community of Flatwoods on the front page of the world's newspaper. Lemon and the Nunley boy were about 50 feet ahead of the rest of the party as they hurried up the brush-covered hillside. They noticed a light mist had drifted before them, and as they got closer, they detected a pungent, irritating odor. Near the top of the hill, where the unpleasant odor was strongest, they spotted a red glowing object that pulsated like a faintly glowing mass of red coals. Well, for a moment, they forgot about the irritating aroma. Lemon and Nunley reached an old gateway from which they could see the red object clearly. It was about 25 feet in diameter, maybe 6 feet high. As they stood there trying to figure out if they should approach it, the attention of the entire party was directed to the strange thing on the ground about 75 feet away, and for a moment none of the group noticed the other object about 20 feet away among the bushes on their right. The dog they'd encountered that had accompanied the party growled and bristled, and the entire group turned to see what was wrong. And Gene Lemon turned his flashlight on it. Whatever it was clearly alive, and it was a giant by human standards. The flashlight showed the head and shoulders of a creature slightly under 10 feet tall, wearing a helmet of some sort, projecting from a dark blue-green and greenish-gray body that reflected the flashlight beams like rubber-lashed silk. Well, we're going to talk more about the Flatwoods Monster in our next show. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.